From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening hour of Forum, protectionism or free trade is an ongoing perennial American debate, and it's opened up once more with the $900 billion economic stimulus bill because of a Buy American provision that was included in it. Canada and the European Union pressed Congress to drop the provision, which critics said could violate NAFTA and World Trade Organization rules and start a trade war, and the Senate agreed just last night to water it down. But Buying American appears to have wide support. We'll hear from both sides in the hour ahead, and we'll take up the question of to buy or not to buy American, that is, with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, Republican Senator John McCain introduced legislation to take out a controversial Buy American provision from the nearly $900 billion massive economic stimulus bill, which passed through the House of Representatives. And just last night, Senator McCain's amendment failed. However, President Obama said Congress should look at dropping or changing the provision to avoid starting a trade war. And yesterday, at the urging of the White House and White House officials, I should say, the Senate agreed to water down the Buy American stipulation, which would have required iron, steel, and manufactured goods used in public works projects funded by the stimulus bill to be U.S. made. And it would have allowed for preferences for U.S. steel companies and other domestic manufacturers. And that provision had strong support from congressional Democrats and labor unions and has been opposed by many Republicans, business groups, and economists. This hour, we want to take up and discuss the wider issue of free trade and protectionism, as well as looking at this provision, which continues to be controversial. Joining us for the hour, Harley Shaken, who is with us from Berkeley, professor in global economy and specialized in labor and global economy at UC Berkeley, and author of Work Transformed, Automation and Labor in the Computer Age. And welcome, Professor Shaken.
It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Nice also to have David Henderson with us, who's joining us this morning from Monterey. He's a research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics. And welcome, David Henderson.
Thanks, Michael.
Glad to have you both. Harley Shaken, let me begin with you. I just want to update listeners on this. The language that was approved by the Senate said such provision should, quote, be applied in a manner consistent with U.S. obligations under international agreements. And what that means is that 50 nations covered by treaties with the U.S. and many entitled to exceptions to the restrictions will be in a different category. Many of those countries, of course, were in the European Union protesting this legislation. Explain to us, though, why, just on the surface of things, buying American, or at least stipulating that things ought to be bought only American, stimulates the economy when others say it's going to create retaliatory trade wars.
Oh, I think it won't create retaliatory trade wars. But the key is the federal government is putting a lot of money into the economy as a stimulus package, which there's broad consensus is vital as we speak. The key then is two goals here. One is to create as many jobs as possible. And certainly the second goal in terms of manufacturing is to ensure a vibrant U.S. manufacturing base going forward. So the language in question here isn't some new form of protectionism. It's something that we've really had for 70 years. It simply indicates in the original language of the Senate bill that the federal government, if it's putting money to create jobs and to create a more vibrant manufacturing base, gives preference to firms that are going to manufacture those goods in the U.S. first. Not under all circumstances. There are a number of important exceptions, but it's simply indicating that the first line of maximizing the multiplier effect, that is, each tax dollar put into the stimulus creating the maximum number of jobs, would be done by purchasing domestically manufactured products to start.
Did you see the Peterson Institute of International Economics study on this that said that it would create as few as maybe 1,000 new jobs and cost U.S. more jobs abroad?
I certainly did see the study. I think it was done in the back of an envelope. I think the numbers are unusually low that reflect the ideology of the authors of the study. And the same two authors told us when NAFTA was being debated that it would result in a $9 to $12 billion trade surplus each year going forward from 1994. Instead, we've wound up with a $50 to $60 billion trade deficit with Mexico alone. So I think those numbers are a bit suspect.
You're also suspect of the idea that this could provoke trade retaliation, but some feel very differently than that. Thomas Donahue, for example, who's president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, says that if we refuse to buy foreign-made goods, well, they're going to do the same.
Okay, let me read a very brief statement here. And let's assume that the newly appointed, Karzai in the U.S. said this. And the statement is, and I'm quoting here, there is no question of the state helping a manufacturer which would purely and simply decide to close one or more plants in the United States. In return, we expect exemplary commitments in terms of the quantity of cars produced in the United States and in terms of the chain of suppliers, end quote. This is the kind of statement that Tom Donahue is saying would provoke a trade war. This wasn't said by the newly appointed or soon to be appointed Karzai. This was said by the Prime Minister of France. It is the condition under which the French government is going to provide an auto bailout package to French manufacturers, and it indicates in no uncertain terms, endorsed by President Sarkozy, a conservative president, that for the auto manufacturers to get money, they must produce the cars in France. Now, we have to say, is that starting a trade war with the U.S.? I think there's a bit of odd rhetoric here, putting the specter of a trade war here where I think it really doesn't exist.
And Harley Shaikin with us from Berkeley is professor there and specializes in labor and global economy. His book is Work Transformed, Automation and Labor in the Computer Age. David Henderson's with us from Monterey. He's editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics and a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. So, David Henderson, this is protectionism as you see it and perilous for the United States economically?
Yes, it is. And in fact, it's interesting. You know, the Hoover Institution is named after Herbert Hoover, and unfortunately, I think Obama is following in Herbert Hoover's footsteps. There's this myth out there that Herbert Hoover was a laissez-faire president who did nothing about the Depression. In fact, Hoover was quite active, and he turned a fairly serious recession into a major depression, into the Great Depression.
Because of the Smoot-Hawley Act?
That was a major factor, and there were a couple others. One of the main other things he did was he tried to keep wages high. He persuaded businessmen to keep wages high, when if wages had fallen, it would have priced a lot of workers back into employment. And so by keeping wages high, he did what later Franklin Roosevelt did by law. He did by jawboning major manufacturers at the time, like GE and so on. So back to the protectionism part. The Smoot-Hawley bill was set out as a minor, a small increase in protection and barriers to trade for farmers, for the agricultural sector in the United States. But it became a Christmas tree bill on which various interests put their own special piece of protection. And by the time Hoover signed it, he signed it reluctantly, but he did sign it, even though over 1,000 economists tried to persuade him not to. And by the way, 1,000 economists is 20% of the economics profession at the time, which is an amazing number.
And by the way, as long as we're using that number of 1,000, it raised U.S. duties on about 1,000, literally thousands of imported goods.
1,000 imported goods to levels of 40% and 50% on many of them. And so what happened was there was retaliation, and so it was a major factor in making the recession more serious and pushing it towards a depression. Now, I am not saying that that this has the same order of magnitude. It's just it's a dangerous step. It could provoke retaliation. And here's the thing: the retaliation is virtually always on completely innocent people. It'd be one thing if they retaliated by, going after the congressman or something who voted for it. But what they do is they single out what people in other countries do, and Bush, by the way, did as one of his last little pokes in the eye of world trade. They single out some innocent sector that's just producing this stuff and exporting it, and figure out some sector that has roughly the same value of production and impose some kind of tariff or restriction on their stuff. So one of Bush's last acts was to retaliate retaliate against the French for some protection they had by putting a 300% tariff on Roquefort cheese. So, you know, it's going to be very hard to find Roquefort cheese now after that. And so all these poor farmers in the south of France are just sitting there innocently doing their business, and suddenly they've lost a major market. And that's one of the problems with these things, is just all the innocent people who are hurt.
It's also the argument that one hears from supporters of this, that such provisions are similar to ones, many of which are on the books already and have been for decades in government procurement policies. That, in other words, this wouldn't be in any way a violation of trade obligations, as those like yourself who are opposed are saying with WTO and NAFTA.
Well, I've heard that argument. I think it certainly is true that this is similar to things already in the books, but this is an expansion, and you know, Prime Minister of Canada says it's violating the agreement. I do think it does violate the agreement, from my understanding of the agreement.
And you think there would be legislation, litigation as a result?
I do.
Yeah. And what about the notion that it actually stimulates the economy?
Well, here's the thing. Now, Harley kind of focused on jobs created, but most economists, when they're here's how economists think about stimulating the economy. What you want is for value to be produced, not for jobs to be produced. Imagine that everyone could get the same value of output by working half as hard, but half as number of hours. In a sense, we've lost half the jobs, but that would be a great outcome because we've got more value. And a famous French economic journalist in the early 1800s named Frédéric Bastiat pointed out that really when you start thinking about jobs as the be-all and end-all, you get distracted from thinking about value, value created as the be-all and end-all. And so what we're going to have, I mean, let's assume, which I don't think is true, that government with this, quote, stimulus, unquote, is going to create a lot of valuable things. I think it's mainly going to be wasted. This increases the waste because it leads to the only reason to have a Buy American Act is if the American stuff for a given quality is more expensive. If it were the same price, then there'd be no point. You wouldn't have to require that they buy American. And so we're getting less value created for a given expenditure. And now, I want to just also look at that Peterson study for a minute. Now, Harley's absolutely right that the whole idea of predicting, you know, what NAFTA was going to do, that was just a fool's errand to start with. That's not how I defended NAFTA. I defended NAFTA on basic principles that at least it's a move towards free trade. And so, you know, you can't look at it's very hard to predict what the number of jobs created or what the trade surplus will be, et cetera, as a result. But here's the thing. What the authors at the Peterson Institute did with this particular provision was looked at the actual steel industry, looked at the actual amount of steel that they thought would be bought under this law, and then translated that into the number of jobs. So that's a very microeconomic kind of analysis, and it's much more likely to be correct. And so let's say they're wrong. It's not 1,000 jobs. It's 2,000 jobs. The point is that's rounding error, not only in the U.S. economy, but even in the steel industry, which has about 150,000 jobs.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking about a Buy American clause that is in or was in the stimulus package. It's been watered down to some extent, but it certainly set off a heated debate among unions, lawmakers, and U.S. trading partners about Buy America. And Harley Shagan, let me take you a little closer to home here. I'm looking at an op-ed by Douglas Irwin that appeared in New York Times earlier this week. And he says, in rebuilding the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge in the 1990s, the California Transit Authority complied with state rules mandating the use of domestic steel unless it was at least 25% more expressive than imported steel. A domestic bid came in at 23% above the foreign bid, and so the more expensive American steel had to be used. Because of the large amount of steel used in the project, California taxpayers had to pay a whopping $400 million more for the bridge. So it's going to cost more to have to buy American?
Not necessarily. In some cases it might, but it depends how you account it. We are putting upwards of $800 billion into the economy right now to stimulate it. An important, a critical part of that is to create jobs. So we are not by measuring simply the cost of the steel in this current economic environment. We're not measuring the cost to the federal government of unemployment compensation. If you have unemployed workers as a result of a purchase, the damage to the manufacturing base, all the related jobs that could be lost, the Medicaid expenses. If you factor all of that in, you're talking about much less cost in terms of buying American on these kinds of projects. We're under unusual economic circumstances right now. We have got a deepening recession of great severity and uncertain length. The federal government is intervening with tens of billions of dollars to put people back to work, to create the purchasing power that we want to get us out of this recession. And we have to ask, what's the most effective way to do that in terms of each dollar of the stimulus when it goes for goods? If we take that dollar of stimulus and the goods are manufactured in China, we may get a good deal, but it's hardly putting Americans back to work, creating the vibrancy for the economy that's essential for the entire world. So I think we've got to put this in a specific context, and the urgency of the situation speaks for itself. And as in terms of Dave's comments, as I heard them, he's opposed to the stimulus package per se and is arguing that the creation of jobs are not all that important. I would say in California today, with 9.2% unemployment and climbing, the creation of jobs is the central issue. And the flip side of creating jobs is creating purchasing power. And we're going to need both to get us out of this recession.
Let me go back, though, to the question of cost with you. GE and Caterpillar were opposed to this initial American provision because of the fear of not getting contracts abroad. And if you go back to, 2001, 2003, the Bush administration put on safeguard tariffs on certain steel products. And we are talking about steel here, from various countries, in an attempt to prevent the steel mills from closing. And as I'm sure you recall, the foreign steelmakers found other markets during that span, China and the Mideast. And as a result, U.S. demand for steel heated up again in 2004. Steel prices skyrocketed by close to 50%. That's according to the Labor Department. Can we really afford this?
Oh, I think this is a very, very different context right now. This is where all industries are being impacted and where there is not an area of shortage for most of the manufactured goods we're talking about. We also have to look at the fact that virtually every other industrial country in the world is pursuing similar policies to ensure domestic employment increases. I read that statement a moment ago from the Prime Minister of France in no uncertain terms, saying they need domestic sourcing to get the French economy going, and getting the French economy going is going to create a healthier global economy. China, Russia, Brazil, and India are not party to any of the regulations or agreements on government procurement. So they won't even be covered by the softening of the language in the Senate bill that President Obama proposed and was evidently passed last night. So what we're talking about here is not a return to protectionism. It's rather a concentrating on stimulating economies in the most effective way we know how. And domestic purchasing is really part and parcel of that, given where we are and given what this context looks like right now in terms of government procurement.
And Harley Shaken with us from Berkeley this morning is a professor there in labor and global economy at UC Berkeley. And David Henderson with us from Monterey is a research fellow with the Hoover Institution. And David Henderson, actually, Harley Shaken is completing an article he told us about Toyota Corollas built mainly in Fremont, Ford Fusions built mainly in Mexico. There's a lot of confusion here about how you would buy American cars, for example, with General Motors and Chrysler facing this big deadline on how to get out of bankruptcy, February 17th. How do you get Americans to buy American if you don't put it into a bill like this or if you don't make it into legislation?
By making a better product or having a given product at a lower price. I mean, that's just the standard way firms compete. And the great thing about competition and free trade is you don't have a government agency saying where you're going to buy your car, where you're going to buy your steel, where you're going to buy your coffee. You have thousands and millions of individual consumers making those choices based on the net benefits to them. And so that's what I want to move back to. I would have liked Bush not to have agreed to that bailout after the Congress voted not to have a bailout of the auto industry, but he didn't have much courage, and he He agreed to it. But, you know, I just think that the way you get people to buy things is to produce good things. And if they don't produce good things, then you don't buy them.
What about the argument? We kept hearing this argument, though, that the Bush administration went overboard to try to really induce a free market and competition and all sorts of laissez-faire free enterprise. And
I don't know where that comes from. You're right. I've read people say that. I wrote an article in Cato's Policy Report taking on this myth that there was this huge amount of deregulation during the Bush administration. I mean, there was not. The number of regulators increased. The number of regulations increased. There just was not this just golden era of laissez-faire. We're much more regulated economy now, except for one major provision of the New Deal, than we were in the New Deal.
And your feeling is that if we go the protectionist route, we are really going to be retaliated against. I want to mention here that Chancellor Merkel of Germany, in fact, the world's largest exporter, just today hailed this decision by the Senate to water down a Buy American clause from the stimulus plan as a good signal. And again, you're in agreement with the notion that we would face some very serious retaliation.
I'm in agreement with the view that we would face retaliation. Again, I don't know how serious, but I do know this, that it would. There's likely to be retaliation, and that the retaliation will hurt. And remember that, if Harley says, well, we need to just look at these jobs, he's just doing one side of the accounting. The other side is how many jobs are lost when there is retaliation. And you know, so you save 1,000 steel jobs, or maybe 2,000, and so you save unemployment insurance for 1,000 or 2,000 people. But on the other hand, you pay more for those items, and we lose jobs elsewhere, which means people who were producing things that people in other countries wanted to buy, those governments prevented their people from buying them.
Harley Shaken, let me get a response from you, if I could.
Well, I think David is really arguing that markets themselves are all that we need. And that's an argument that's intriguing prior to August of 2008. It's a market that relatively few make today. By the underlying logic of what he's putting forward, we really don't need any regulation of our banking system because it's in the self-interest of bankers to regulate themselves. That was Alan Greenspan's argument prior to August of 2008. It's certainly not his argument now. And I'd like to point out, I'm not talking about some vast new protectionist regime, nor am I talking about restricting anyone's right to buy a product of any kind in this context. We're talking about a very limited, though critical, provision in the stimulus bill where we are using taxpayer dollars to stimulate the economy. And the core of that bill is how do we ensure that each taxpayer dollar creates the maximum number of domestic jobs? It's something that the president of France in the French context has embraced fully. He's a conservative president, but he understands the urgency of this situation. In terms of protectionism on a day-to-day basis, you couldn't find an example that's more extreme than China. Yet there isn't any massive retaliation towards China in the global economy today. So I think we have to be realistic, put this argument in the current context.
Well, I'm going to put the context of how do you feel about all this? That is, our listeners, we're talking about steel being perhaps only bought as an American product, domestically made, but also preferences to American products, and the whole question of Buy America and what kind of retaliation would result. You can join us toll-free. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls, and that will work whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius XM satellite. Let's hear from you. It's 866-733-6786, toll-free, or email us, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with a couple of Bay Area academics about trade wars and really about specifically a clause in President Obama's stimulus package that has set off a heated debate, which is essentially designed to protect steel-producing states in terms of buying only steel from domestic production. We're talking about the pros and cons of preferences, really, to American-made products, and that whole picture in terms of what it could set off in the way of trade wars, protectionism, like I said, a perennial debate. With us from Berkeley is Harley Shaken, who specializes in labor and the global economy at UC Berkeley, where he's a professor, and he's author of Work Transformed, Automation and Labor in the Computer Age. And with us from Monterey, David Henderson, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics. And we're going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. But David Henderson, I want to get your response to what Professor Shagan said about China. Not much retaliation and yet a lot of protectionism.
Well, he's absolutely right. There hasn't been much retaliation. But, I mean, if you look at Congress, they sure have tried. I mean, they, you know, the idea that we haven't had retaliation yet, it's kind of to me like the guy who jumps out of the 10th-story building and at every floor on the way down they hear him say, so far, so good. You know, the point is that there's always been pressure to retaliate. And Republicans have led that, Democrats have led that. And so, you know, we're not talking like it's a certain world that if you do this, there will be retaliation. And this is why I said I think there'll be retaliation. The probability of retaliation is substantial, and I think that that's dangerous.
And what about the probability of litigation, Harley Shaken, from the WTO or from NAFTA?
Oh, I think on the litigation front, it's almost a certainty, but that's far different than retaliation. What we have here is a limited bill, and I would point out it isn't just steel products. In the Senate version, it's all manufactured products. What we have is a certainty, meaning that more jobs will be created in the U.S. if there is domestic procurement wherever possible as part of the stimulus package. Those jobs are a certainty. What is a possibility is some sort of retaliation, and not a very high one. I think it's almost a certainty that we'll have litigation with certain countries, but there's a complex web of very arcane at times rules that govern procurement. For example, in the European Union, which has made all these noises, governments are able to insist on domestic procurement in the EU on issues related to water, to telecommunications, to energy, and in some areas of information technology more generally. All those are legal, although absolutely by European provisions that are part of the EU. So you've got a complicated situation here, but in terms of context, an urgent situation for creating jobs immediately and for longer term, ensuring that we have a healthy, productive manufacturing base. And these provisions really address both those. So it's a bit odd that we've had such an uproar over it. Part of the debate really has the flavor of August 2008 debate of markets versus regulation. We're living in a different era since the financial system collapsed and since the economy began imploding. There's a generally a broader sense that we do need regulation. We do need more of a government hand in this. The billions that are being talked about in terms of the stimulus package are proof of that. And this notion of domestic procurement really ensures that that's used in the most effective way.
Well, David Henderson, let me get you to comment before I go to our callers and bring them into this about what you just heard from Harley Shaken. This is a different era that you can't speak about how we should be free of regulation, particularly after what we saw as a collapse in Wall Street and all the rest that followed.
Yeah, I don't agree. I think that it is true that there were lots of people just going in with their eyes closed and making bad investments. And so I don't blame it totally on government, but I do blame a large part of it on government regulation. We had the Community Reinvestment Act, which I talked about on your show a couple of months ago, that was beefed up in the mid-90s in the Clinton administration and pushed banks to make loans to people who were unlikely to repay them, loans to buy houses. That didn't help. There's this myth out there there's this truth out there that's been turned into a myth. And here's the truth, that Larry Summers, when he was in the Clinton administration, and Alan Greenspan and so on, all opposed regulation of credit default swaps. And that's true. But what's not understood is that Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, that's the entity, the government agency that regulates the commodity futures markets, wanted those things on the market. Now, the way it was pitched is we're going to regulate them, but what really it was we're going to allow them to be bought and sold in commodity futures markets, and that means the regulations that go with that. So when Greenspan and Summers et al. Opposed that, what they were essentially doing is saying, let's just let the big boys play, and let's have these things regulated, or let's have them assessed by the credit rating agencies that it turns out did a very bad job, instead of having them sold on a market where you can look at what this particular seed credit default swap is selling for and know what the market estimate of the risk is. So you bring in all these decentralized pieces of information that people have into that market. That didn't happen. So there's a case where we didn't move more towards free markets, and as a result, we got these major companies making these bad bets, and we got a big part of the problem we have.
All right, let me bring in our callers, and John, you're first up. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much. I just wanted to weigh in on the Buying American clause. I think that, in general, the idea of protectionism is not a good strategy. I was actually against the auto bailout because, as unfortunate as I was, that factory workers would be losing their jobs because, you know, their boards were short-sighted and they were designing the wrong product. I mean, you know, Toyota got the drop on everybody with the Prius, but, you know, I still thought that the idea of bailing out an industry that didn't respond to market demands was a strategy that would not scale. That said, I think when there's this much money on the line and this, you know, when it's all taxpayer dollars, the idea of trying to make sure the money stays in American borders and circulates to as many people as possible before it ends up offshore somewhere is a good thing, because that way more people get the benefit of that money being in circulation rather than just, you know, dropping it into, you know, construction job who then sends it overseas to get steel or something like that.
Yeah, I'm glad you weighed in on that, John. Thank you so much. Harley Shaken, as I alluded to earlier, since John mentions again the auto industry, and he mentions Toyota, which, by the way, is down in sales. I just read about 30%, and they're making cars that are
right,
supposedly more desirable. Things look pretty bleak in terms as this economy continues to go south in terms of buying automobiles. But how do you get Americans to buy American?
Well, that's another issue. And I think John really described the situation with the Senate or the House stimulus bills very, very elegantly and simply. It's simply getting money to circulate domestically at a critical moment. The broader issue of ensuring a vibrant manufacturing base in the United States is going to require a lot. It will require, I think, a considerable amount from the federal government. The current collapse of the domestic industry absolutely reflects mistakes the industry made, but it also reflects the unexpected, in terms of severity and timing, meltdown of the entire economy. That's why I think it's vital to have that bailout. But I think John really explained very well the importance, even the urgency, of the Buy American provisions in the bailout bill that's coursing through the Congress.
David Henderson, want to take issue here?
Yeah, both with John and with Harley. People talk about the American auto industry. Well, we've got a very vibrant American auto industry owned by companies in Germany and Japan and so on. They're hiring American workers. So, you know, actually one of Harley's colleagues, who I was on the show with a couple of months ago, Robert Reich, wrote an excellent piece in the Harvard Business Review back in the late 80s, early 90s, I think it was, titled "Who Is Us?" And the idea is, when we talk about us, when we talk about Americans and buying American, how do we handle the issue that so many plants in America are owned by foreign firms? So if we're talking about buying from GM and Chrysler and Ford, what we're really talking about is benefiting the shareholders of GM, Chrysler, and Ford. I mean, obviously the workers too. But if we talk about buying from Toyota or Honda or BMW, all of which have plants in the United States, we're talking about benefiting the shareholders in those countries, but also we're talking about benefiting American workers. And so I just think that the discussion would be much more honest and much more clear if people talked about the specific part of the U.S. auto industry they want to bail out and not keep calling it the U.S. auto industry. It's a part of it. It's a fraction of it. It's a big fraction, but it's a fraction of it.
And more of your calls. Anna, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, I'm curious to know how does the unfair labor practices in China affect the economy here in the United States, the fact that they can sell their products so cheaply. A lot of the people that buy those cheap products lost their jobs to China.
David Henderson.
Well, I'd want to know which unfair labor practices Anna's talking about. My guess is it's not so much unfair labor practices, although there might be some, but rather it's due to the relatively low wages that are paid in China because of relatively low productivity. I mean, they're still a developing country. They're not a first world country yet. And so, you know, those wages tend to be lower. And again, the reason free trade works is it's based on differences. We tend to produce the things in which we have a comparative advantage. They produce the things in which they have a comparative advantage. And we're all better off for it. I mean, we're all better off in the long run. It is true that some people in some industries lose their jobs in the short run. But if we could push a button and say, no free trade, just produce everything internally, we would be substantially worse off. Everyone would be worse off than if we have free trade throughout.
Let's get Arthur on from Palo Alto. Arthur, join us.
Thank you. This is very interesting. One of the problems with what's going on is that our U.S. corporate tax system is actually at odds with what you're trying to do. We've been subsidizing shipping jobs overseas with tax credits when you shut down a factory. A value-added tax, in contrast, at 20% level, would actually increase competitiveness of U.S. goods by 44%.
Harley Shaken?
Well, let me actually answer something that Anna raised a moment ago before getting to what, you know, Arthur's talking about. I think Anna has an excellent point. If you have a society or an economy where workers cannot join independent unions or bargain collectively, you can have an important labor cost advantage. In the export industries in China, as in many other low-wage countries, the productivity and quality are often comparable to what you will find in Japan or the U.S. or Germany. The wages are very low because workers lack labor rights, which gives a country an important advantage but a very unfair advantage and pushes wages globally down about the last thing in the world we need right now. So that's very much part of this mix. This isn't protectionism. It's establishing rules of the game that ensure that trade expands but that ordinary people benefit from that expansion. In terms of what Arthur's raising, I think it is important to look at tax policy and the ways in which it may inadvertently or at times directly encourage investment outside of the United States, because that's often at the expense of American workers and American taxpayers.
A lot of emails coming in about manufacturing and the manufacturing base being really central to this whole discussion we're having about so-called protectionism and free trade. And Shannon, for example, writes, the U.S. age of manufacturing is over. Let it go. Stop trying to save jobs that can't compete in a global market. Let those countries that can provide the service efficiently do it. Encourage free trade. Use the stimulus package to better our education system so we can compete in this information age. And here's Doug, who says, I've heard theories about our economy for decades. They sound great when you hear them, but from where I'm sitting, they are self-serving at best. How many economists does it take to not know that we were about to have all of our Wall Street firms be lost to bankruptcy and fire sales? It is obvious to me that we need to have manufacturing be a bigger part of our economy than it is now. We cannot be a consumer economy. Has any economist ever looked at what a healthy ratio of manufacturing as a part of a nation's GDP is? And Pat says, to what degree are we paying the price of allowing our manufacturing sector to decline while finance became dominant in our economy? If we buy overseas, it's okay. Those overseas purchases buy someone else back from us. That way jobs are generated on both sides. Do we have much to sell? Free trade won't help us if we don't. And here's Tom, who says, I read a good portion of H.R. 1, and it's a Senate version. So far, I know of only one place it covers Buy American, and that's steel production, and it is written fairly. This legislation is for the American economy. I find it offensive that while we're trying to boot up our economy, foreign economies are planning to get a piece of the action. I also think that foreign economies would find it offensive if the reverse was happening. Excuse me. And here's Anita, who says, I'm not normally a protectionist, but it seems to me that the main point of this stimulus package is to create U.S. jobs, and improving our infrastructure is an important and much-needed side benefit. The point is not to build as much road as possible. If it costs a little more and we get a little less road, for example, I don't think we should care. This is a jobs bill. And this is why there is funding for the NEA, which I think is great. Would we fund a ballet company in Russia with these funds? Artists in France? I don't think so. Let's go to more of your calls. We'll go to Mary in Indiana. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, sir. I'll make it very short and simple. I hear a lot of people say, well, the reason why the domestic automotive companies are having such a rough time, my father retired from a General Motors plant in Marion, Indiana, and me and him talk about this every evening. And he said, Chris, the reason why the foreign car companies don't have the trouble we do, they don't have a retired workforce like we do. He said, plus they knew what they was doing when they went to the South to build their foreign car companies because the money income down there wasn't what it is in the North, and they could pay the people less money, and they get huge tax abatements to come in and build just like a Walmart store does. They say, look, we're going to bring you $8 to $10 an hour jobs, but we want you to pay us to come in. And this is my biggest point. My father told me, he said, Chris, a lot of people on Wall Street and all these big government hotshots don't understand is Toyota and Honda, 90-some percent of their cars are not made here. They're simply assembled here.
Now, that point is certainly worthy of taking under advisement. It's been made on this program in this hour and many times. Harley Shaken, get a response.
Oh, I think your caller from Marion really is right on the money here. General Motors has over 400,000 retirees in the United States. Toyota has about 400 retirees. Overwhelmingly, the difference in total wage and benefit costs between GM and Toyota simply reflects that GM has a strong retirement package and, more to the point, has so many retirees. That security after you've put 30 years into a company is what characterizes a decent society. We don't want to get rid of that in the name of competitiveness, because ultimately we're all going to pay a price as a result of that. In terms of the content of the cars, that's what's critical. It's not the fact that GM, Ford, and Chrysler happen to be headquartered in Detroit. Nike happens to be headquartered in Oregon, but it doesn't do any manufacturing in the United States. The domestically based automakers, the Detroit Three, still do most of their manufacturing in the U.S. and a much higher percentage than their international counterparts. That's a very easy thing to measure. So we're not speaking abstractly of if a company has an American flag in front of its building, in front of its headquarters, that's a U.S. company. We're talking about the creation of domestic jobs, in the case of this procurement, at a critical moment. And that's a very easy thing to measure.
Okay, coming back to this, David Henderson, that this is a jobs bill, as one of the listeners pointed out, and that we need jobs in this recession.
I'd like to reply to that, plus a couple of the other things. I want to hit a couple things. One is about tax policy. It is true that a lot of companies are, producing abroad because of our tax policy. But the big one is the corporate tax, which is 35%, and it's one of the highest corporate tax rates now in the developed world. And so, various economists have done studies that say the government, if it cut the corporate tax by 10%, would not lose 10% of the revenues that come from it. Would lose much less because it would bring in a lot of corporations. The other thing I want to point out is that manufacturing jobs are disappearing everywhere, and it's not because of trade, it's because of productivity. China is losing, and even before this recession, China was losing manufacturing jobs. Why? Because it's becoming much more productive. We now produce 5 to 6 times the amount of steel with a given worker that we did than what we produced 30 or 40 years ago. It's productivity. It's not just trade. And in fact, if you really use these arguments against trade in order to protect jobs, you should also use them against productivity and say, you know what, let's ban innovation. Let's make sure that things get produced inefficiently so that we can have even more jobs producing them. I think everyone would see the absurdity of that. We would get less value for our money, and so the argument that you would use against trade, you would use against manufacturing, against productivity and innovation, and so I think it should make you kind of think twice about your argument against trade. And one of the writers said, free trade won't help us if we don't figure out what to produce. That's true, but it's only free trade that can help us decide what to produce. It gives the market signals. It gives the price signals that tell us where our comparative advantage is.
Here's Mike from Sunnyvale who says, I think it's clearly the case that protectionism costs more domestic jobs than it saves. But the jobs the U.S. saved by protectionism are presumably at the expense of foreign jobs. In our globalized economy, we're all in the same economic hole together. It is more important than ever for all nations to invest in what they do best to get a global recovery from this global recession. And Kurt in San Francisco says, here's a thought, suspend the hiring of foreign workers for a year. All right. Actually, I just want to remind you that we're talking with Harley Shaken, who is a professor in education and geography and directs the Center for Latin American Studies and specializes in labor and the global economy at UC Berkeley, author of Work Transformed, Automation and Labor in the Computer Age, and David Henderson with us from Monterey, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics. You're listening to Forum, and this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, which we hope you will do unvarnishedly, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And more of your calls. We go to Michael next. Michael, thanks for waiting.
Hi, this is Michael from San Francisco.
Yes, hi.
I would like to say that instead of putting a Buy American clause in the stimulus package, why not raise the cost of foreign products by providing inducements to increase overseas wages and environmental conditions? And I would say in terms of regulation, for a larger contract such as a steel contract, say over $1 million, over $10 million, we have foreign companies post a 10% bond, something large enough to incentivize American companies to investigate situations where overseas companies pay less than median wage in their countries or have extraordinarily bad environmental conditions.
Well, it's a great way to screw poor people. I mean, that's what he's talking about is taking people in these countries that have lower wages who have these opportunities. Most of them are not there involuntarily. The vast majority of them are taking those jobs voluntarily. And if they are put out of that market, basically they're hurt. And so we're going to help people in America who are on average among the best off people in the world at the expense of these poor people in these other countries.
But doesn't this incentivize raising wages overseas?
Yes, that's the point. It incentivizes raising wages, so at those higher wages, not as many people will be employed. That's kind of Herbert Hoover economics.
We're back to Herbert Hoover again. Harley Shaken.
Yeah, I think Herbert Hoover plays a real role here. We're not arguing protectionism versus expanded trade. I'm all for expanded trade. What we're arguing here ultimately is market fundamentalism, that is a complete reliance on the market versus anything else, versus a more balanced approach that ensures broader standards for the global economy that mean that Chinese workers get a fairer share of what at times is very high productivity. That's the new reality, that productivity in the export sector is very high and that U.S. workers aren't hurt as a result of that. At a point in California where we have 9.2% unemployment, I think to talk about American workers as the best off in the world doesn't do somebody who's losing their home, pulling their kids out of college, can't make a car payment. It doesn't really address the core needs that they have. We've got a great opportunity here more broadly in terms of expanding trade with rules that benefit people, more immediately ensuring that the stimulus package really does have an impact on Americans that are suffering enormously, those directly impacted and those who fear they could be impacted next week or next month. Now, these are critical issues. One final small point. Sometimes what seems least expensive at the moment turns out to be more expensive. You mentioned, Michael, the Bay Bridge and the steel in the Bay Bridge earlier. Well, it turns out that the construction of the Bay Bridge has reached a bit of an impasse because the Chinese steel that was bought evidently could have defective welds, or at least welds that have to be reinspected, that is raising cost considerably. And that certainly wasn't fixed in the initial contract, nor would it have been as likely if you have a supplier that at least geographically is much closer to the work you're doing.
Actually, the way the Chinese are sending products out may be one of the bigger boosts for the economy as far as American-made things. I don't mean to be wry here, but let me go to more of your calls. Ken, join us. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. I would just like to say, wouldn't it be a great boon to our economy, to these giant, these corporations we've been talking about, like GM and U.S. Steel, if we had a nationalized health care program and took those health care costs away from the corporations like they do in other countries, in like Japan, Britain, France, et cetera, and Germany, where they don't have to deal with those costs? That would make them much more competitive on a world market.
Well, when you're talking about retirement costs and health care costs, you know, you've got huge issues there that, alas, we don't have time for. But, Ken, I'm glad you called. In fact, we are coming, unfortunately, to the end of the hour. And a good hour it's been, thanks to our two guests and thanks to your calls. And I want to thank Harley Shaken again for being with us. He's professor in education and geography and directs the Center for Latin American Studies at UC Berkeley. And his book is Work Transformed, Automation and Labor in the Computer Age. Thank you for being with us, Harley.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
And always a pleasure to have you. And likewise with David Henderson, who is with us from Monterey, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And another hour of forum is coming your way. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk about treating the untreatable with Dr. Ira Steinman, who is a longtime psychiatrist who works with psychotics. And we want to extend thanks to our whole staff. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our interns are Crystal Davis, Will Duke, Kylie Gordon, Diana Kwan, and Sophia Salazar-Rubio. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. And remind you that you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org or call our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.